All right. Good evening. I'd like to begin, before I do anything else, by asking everybody to turn off your cell phones, please. Okay, now that we've taken care of that business. Good evening, I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education here at The Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at The Modern. This is our first lecture for the Spring 2012 series. We have a very exciting lineup that runs through April 17th. You can go to the website and check it out. I suggest that you mark your calendars for your favorites. Dates and descriptions are there. Since the schedule was posted, I've had numerous and very exuberant responses to this lineup. I always tell you this is the best lineup yet, and nobody believes me because, of course, I select them, so I can't be totally objective. But I'm actually getting the word from the street that this is a very good lineup. And I agree. I think that that's evident by tonight's attendance. What a wonderful way to kick it off. I want to see some of this love next Tuesday for Valentine's Day, when we have art historian Andy Campbell here to present one facet of his current project, Bound Together, which is an academic study of gay and lesbian leather communities in the 1970s. The title of that lecture is The Practice of Sex, The Work of History, The Work of Sex, The Practice of History. Fascinating. So be here. It's a good Valentine's date. Many of the Tuesday evening lectures, while not directly related, were planned with our upcoming exhibition, Glenn Ligon America, in mind. There's also an exciting array of additional programs that were created directly in conjunction with the exhibition, and the dates and descriptions of those are also on The Modern's website. Tonight, of course, is the pinnacle of such programming, with the artist and curator here to offer an overview of Glenn Ligon's career and a preview of sorts of this exhibition, which we are all looking forward to with great expectation and anticipation. Scott Rothkopf, the curator of Glenn Ligon America, received his undergraduate and graduate degrees from Harvard, during which time he instigated and then curated an exhibition of conceptual artist Mel Bochner of his photographs and related drawings from the 70s, which opened at the Fogg Museum in 2012. As well, during his time at Harvard, he invited the French artist Pierre Wy to do a site-specific installation that became the puppet musical This Is Not a Time for Dreaming. Scott also produced a book in conjunction with the Mel Bochner exhibition and worked with the likes of Jasper Johns on Jasper Johns' Catenary. He authored Jeff Koons' Hulk Elvis, as well as other books, and is a contributor of the to the upcoming Whitney Biennial catalog. All of which I note to make the point, if anyone is unaware, that Scott Rothkopf is ambitious and has had something significant to say since the beginning of his career, even as a student. After Harvard, he became senior editor at Art Forum, an impressive title and a demanding position, which he held for 5 years before being hired as curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Described as whip smart and charming in one announcement of his new job at the Whitney. I think his mother would agree with that description. Scott was immediately assigned the 25-year retrospective of artist Glenn Ligon, which was a perfect fit after having a relationship with the artist as a writer while at Art Forum, which is, of course, in part the reason we're here tonight. And, of course, joining Scott is the man of the hour, Glenn Ligon. Glenn received a BA from Wesleyan University and completed the prestigious Whitney Independent Study Program in 1985. Like Scott, Glenn seems to have hit the ground running with a solo exhibition at the Hirshhorn as early as 1993. and he was included in the iconic exhibition Black Male at the Whitney in 1994. Other solo exhibitions have included the Brooklyn Museum of Art in 1996, the Studio Museum in Harlem in 2001, the Dia Center for Arts in 2003, and the Power Plant in Toronto in 2005, which traveled then to the CAM in Houston in 2006, and I think many of you had the great opportunity of seeing that exhibition. Glenn's work has been included in the 1991 and 1993 Whitney Biennials, as well as other biennials and biennales, including the 1997 Venice Biennale and Documenta 11 in 2002. He has been recognized with numerous awards and grants, including three NEAs, a Joan Mitchell, a Guggenheim, and the 2006 Skowhegan Medal for Painting. Interesting and impressive fact that some of you may not know, upon moving to the White House, President Obama had Glenn Ligon's painting, Black Like Me, number 2, installed in the family quarters. So how about that? Yeah, exactly. No doubt an important artist in so many ways, Glenn is also a talented writer. Some of you may recall Glenn being here in 2005 for the Tuesday evening, for one of the Tuesday evening lectures, after I read Black Light, David Hammons, and the Poetics of Emptiness in Art Forum, which was edited by Scott Rothkopf, and I felt I gained great insight into Glenn Ligon, an artist whose work I had admired for some time, and was convinced at that point that I really had to have Glenn come here and talk about his ideas and his work in Fort Worth so we could hear them firsthand. Thankfully, he graciously accepted, and it's so nice to have him back here. That article is reprinted in the book that both Scott and Glenn collaborated on, Yourself in the World, Selected Writings and Interviews, which happens to be the subject of our first reading group on March 15th, which is some of that program I referred to earlier, so you need to go online and check that out, as mentioned. Needless to say, tonight shows every sign of being absolutely fabulous. I'm so glad you could be here. And lest I forget, you can get more of Glenn Ligon tomorrow at 1 on KER's Think program with Chris Boyd. So I'll give everybody a moment to jot that down. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming both Scott Rothkopf and Glenn Ligon.
Are we live?
Can you hear us?
Yeah. You can hear us.
Thank you, Terry, for that introduction. I didn't think anyone could make me blush as much as my mom, but now there's a competition vying in this room. We're really so happy to be here in Fort Worth, and I did grow up in Dallas and have many memories of this museum in its old home, and this one too, but it really introduced me to a great number of artists. We were talking today about the Kiki Smith show that I remember seeing, I think, when I was in high school or college. And so it's really special to be back here with Glenn's exhibition. We've been in New York and then in L.A., and this really does feel like a great place to have a finale. I want to thank Andrea Carnes also, the curator here at the Fort Worth Museum, who's sitting in the front row and is really the person responsible for bringing us here. She's been a wonderful collaborator, and we're just delighted. I hope all of you will come back to the exhibition after it opens. We're sorry that you can't see it tonight, but we're sort of still finishing up, and it'll be here for about 3 months. You can find those dates on the website. So as Terry mentioned, we're going to start by giving you sort of a preview of the show and kind of a survey of Glenn's work for those of you who may not be that familiar, the kinds of things that he's done over the last 25 years. We don't have a script, but we'll kind of use the slides as our key, and we welcome questions and comments from the audience at the end. So the idea is that we'll talk maybe for 45 minutes or so, and then we can open it up to some conversation.
Yes.
Yes. Glenn likes questions.
Yes.
If you don't get to ask them today, you can call into the radio program tomorrow. He's really looking forward to those callers. Okay, can we go ahead and start with the first slide? This is a cover of the catalog. You can purchase it in the museum bookshop. just as a way of starting, and maybe this is I'm feeling sentimental being at home, but I thought we'd begin even before the show begins with Glenn's sort of I don't know, earliest memories of being interested and exposed to art. He recently wrote a piece that's very beautiful online about his mom and the kinds of experiences he had looking at art as a child when he grew up in New York in the Bronx. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how you first started to make art or learn about art.
Well, I think my I grew up in a working class family in the Bronx and had a sort of traumatic, not traumatic for me, but traumatic for my parents, experience in kindergarten, which was, I'll give you the short version of it. We were supposed to do, you know those things where they give kids a couple of letters of the alphabet and you're supposed to write a word for the letter of the alphabet, like A is for alligator. So the public school that I was going to, the idea was that they wrote out four letters of the alphabet, and this was supposed to take up, filling in these words for these four letters was supposed to take up 45-minute classroom time. So I finished in about 3 seconds. It was about, you know, what do I do now? And I asked my teacher to write out the rest of the alphabet for me, and I filled in words for the rest of the alphabet. And then the next day, the principal of the school called my mother in for a conference because apparently this had never been done in the school before, which I thought was very strange on hearing this story as an adult, but my mother thought was very strange too. And the principal of the school said to her, well, you should really, you know, get Glenn into a private school. I think that would be better for him. And my mother, at that point, was separated from my father, so, and I have an older brother, so the idea of two kids in private school was just not economically feasible. But then my mother said that one of the teachers said something to her that infuriated her so much that she decided that whatever the cost, she was going to send us to private school. One of the teachers, one of my homeroom teachers sitting in on this meeting, said, well, your kid may be smart here, but if they were in a real school, they would just be an average kid. And so my mother decided, let's get him in a real school. I'd rather him be an average kid in a real school than, you know, in this school where, public school where teachers had given up on the kids in kindergarten. So, but I think what was interesting about my art education was that my parents didn't think that being an artist was a viable profession. My mother said to me once, the only artists she'd ever heard of were dead. And she meant Picasso, because she'd read an article about him in Life magazine. But there wasn't any model for being an artist. It didn't seem, you know, there were models for other things, like, you know, working at the post office, which a lot of my relatives did. A lot of my relatives were civil service. But there wasn't a model for what an artist does, how an artist makes money, you know, who buys an artist's work. So that just seemed very bizarre to her. But also, I think she realized that art was part of what an educated person needed to know about. So at the same time, there was this sort of reluctance to sort of engage the idea that I could be an artist. There was a willing acceptance of the idea that I could learn about art. So I was sent to pottery classes in Greenwich Village, you know, when I was 10, and I went to after-school drawing courses at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. So there was this sort of funny kind of, you know, a kind of mixed message of, like, yes, you should know about art, but being an artist was a bit too far, you know, too far afield for her, or for my brother, for my dad as well.
Well, now that we got you up to age 12, let's jump to maybe 20. I show this is a bit of a, I wouldn't say it's a joke, but it's kind of a funny slide comparison, because on the left you have a very famous painting of de Kooning's. It's in MoMA's collection where Glenn spent time as a kid and talks about it. On the right you have a painting that Glenn made in college. And interesting, you don't see anything like this in the show. A little touch of it at the very beginning, which will show you that Glenn really began his career or his love of art as an abstract painter, not engaging all the kinds of topics that you're going to see when you come back to this exhibition. But I wonder if you could talk about what your interest in de Kooning and Terry Winters and some of these artists were in the 80s and your feelings for some of those paintings at MoMA, let's say.
Well, I'd started going to galleries and museums on my own, I think, when I was in high school, definitely in high school. So by the time I was 16, you know, I was going to shows in Soho and New York and looking at galleries, but also going to museums. And particularly the Met, because I was doing these drawing classes there. So after the drawing classes, I would wander around the galleries, but also the Modern and these de Koonings and Pollocks and Franz Klein were kind of the paintings I was seeing on the walls and the paintings that I was really interested in. And I think when I got to college, I still didn't know if I wanted to be an artist. That still wasn't quite real. But I was taking art courses and was very engaged with abstract expressionism. Now, I'm not sure exactly why, because there were lots of other things going on at the time. But I think I had sort of bought the mythology of a kind of paint as liberation. And those artists, you know, seemed to embody that, the way they painted. And so a painting on the right is actually an interesting painting. The title of this painting is Trenchtown. I don't know if you knew that, but
I didn't.
Because it was like, you know, you never saw this painting. But I think I rolled it up and then I gave it to my dad and it's under a bed somewhere. But anyway, it's this abstract painting that has a title that refers to a neighborhood in Kingston, Jamaica. So there was this sort of odd kind of, interest in abstract expressionism and kind of formal issues, but then this sort of title that seems to point to a kind of particular social space or kind of set of political concerns, which isn't really in the painting yet, but in a funny way is what's coming, you know?
I think that's a good segue, because here we have paintings which you will see in the show, the earliest works in the show from 1985, and you can see underneath this kind of very gestural, painterly ground. And then on top, there are texts. And Glenn is an artist who's really known for his use of text in his writing. And this is some of the first time that he started to actually try to get that text into his work. And this struggle, let's say, or this questioning is embodied in these works. And I wonder if you could talk about maybe why you kind of had a brush, let's say, in one hand and a pencil in the other.
Right,
or where did
right,
this
right.
desire to kind of bring writing in?
Well,
come from?
I think de Kooning said that oil paint was invented to depict flesh. And maybe I took that a bit literally, because the texts that are in these sort of very brushy grounds are coming from pornographic magazines. So they're literally descriptions of sort of like fleshy encounters. But I think it was sort of a desire kind of brought on by being in the Whitney program around this time and being exposed to a lot of artists who were using text in their work, people like Barbara Kruger.
Some of them, actually.
Or Basquiat, and thinking about other possibilities for this kind of language of abstraction that I was so invested in, but also I was looking at people like de Kooning, Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg, as a way of putting in a certain kind of content into the paintings. So it was really the sort of move towards language was a way of kind of introducing a new content to the work, because I felt like I'd run into a wall with the kind of abstraction that I was doing, that I felt I had some sort of facility with paint, but there wasn't ideas there. They were kind of emptied out for me, you know.
What's really great, I think, about the first room of there's a stencil, for those of you who don't know what one is. I've got asked this on a tour at the Whitney, so we've included this, which has become a signature tool for both Jasper Johns and for Glenn Ligon. And here you see, in the first room of the exhibition, really this kind of stepping from this painterly background more and more into the text, and that the text is becoming more assertive and more, let's say, anonymous in terms of its treatment. It's no longer Glenn's handwriting. It's less expressive. It's more mechanical, using a stencil. Although you have these grounds and this series of dream books that we'll see on the first wall of the show, really. And I wonder if you could talk about where these texts come from and how the text is getting more assertive. We can show a few different ones.
Well, the texts here were from, as you mentioned, dream books, which were sort of common things. They were dream interpretation books. The difference being that each interpretation of a dream, say if you dreamt of colored people, it would give you the interpretation of what it meant to dream of colored people. And then it would give you this three-digit number, and the number was used to play the numbers, which was this illegal lottery, basically. It's sort of the same idea of, like, you have a dream about your grandchildren and you somehow, you know, play the lottery with their ages or something like that. But it's a much more formalized system of this. And I thought they were really interesting. They were on the bookshelf along with the Reader's Digest condensed books. There were some dream books and, you know, Zora Neale Hurston novels and things like that. But, you know, they were just sort of part of the stuff that was around when I was a kid. And when I made these drawings, I sort of returned to this kind of knowledge that was sort of common folk knowledge, and I thought, well, it's interesting to bring that kind of knowledge into the space of this abstraction, which seemed to need a kind of, you know, kind of pulling down in a way, like to a sort of real experience and sort of, I wouldn't say, you know, deeply autobiographical place, but somehow connected more to my history and environment, you know. So that was kind of the impulse. But the backgrounds were abstract paintings, basically. So I'm still involved with, like, how do you make a surface that's engaging and interesting? And this is, yeah, just a close-up with how the stencils are used, one letter at a time, just.
Yeah, you can see the pencil lines there that he used. There, a lot of these works are sort of more labor-intensive and intuitive in a way, I think, than people sometimes think when they look at them now, especially people are used to typing on computers and things, that each letter is put down one at a time, and that there aren't really guides for how they're going to be spaced. And Glenn's kind of feeling his way across the surface of the object and also through the text. And that kind of dialogue is something that really grows as the show progresses, you'll see. Another painting that has this kind of tension, let's say, between something that's very gestural, which is hard to see here because the ground is white, but when you get in front of it, you'll see how much brushwork there is. And then this text has another very important early painting for Glenn, and maybe you can talk a little bit about this painting or the history of the image that it's referring to, which we can show if you
right.
want to go ahead and go to this image.
Right. March in Memphis, the year Martin Luther King was assassinated, the sanitation workers strike, and a very famous image by, I can't remember if it's Ernest Withers.
It is
or,
Ernest Withers.
Okay, Ernest Withers' photograph. Of these sanitation workers massing to at the beginning of the march, but carrying these signs that said, "I am a man." And I was very interested in that sign before I knew anything actually about what the march was. In fact, I'd seen the sign as a framed poster in a congressman's office on a class trip in high school, and I was sort of fascinated by it. And it sort of stuck in my head for all these years. So this painting was made in 1988. So maybe I'd seen the poster in the mid-70s even. But it sort of took me that long to kind of figure out how to use this kind of image that was sticking with me. And so basically I just decided to use it directly, to make a painting that was sort of reminiscent of that sign. But it's not directly, you know, the lettering has changed, the scale has changed. It was a painting also made with oil paint and enamel paint, so it has a very cracked surface. And but it's an interesting sort of important painting for me because it referred to a sort of history that was outside of my experience, direct experience, because it was talking about this march that happened when I was very young and had no kind of, you know, direct relationship to, except I'm an American. It was in black and white, which a lot of the work that I started using, a lot of the text work I was doing is in black and white. But it was also still painting, too, which was very important to me. Like, there were other ways to use that sign. I could have used more sort of graphic treatment of it, you know, because at the time that this was made, you know, the people that I was aware of were, as I mentioned before, someone like Barbara Kruger, who were doing text and image pieces. So there were other ways to work, but I was very committed to painting as a practice and trying to figure out how painting can hold these sort of social concerns or political concerns, you know.
Well, it's also interesting to me in terms of the actual text that you used and where your work moved, that you're using language here now that is sort of about being someone in the world, let's say, or sort of thinking about how language relates to identity, the way that these men actually had to declare their personhood through language, and the use of that pronoun I, which becomes a real signature pronoun in your work, because you don't really know anymore when these men are carrying this poster, when you're looking at this painting, who this I is. Is this I Glenn Ligon who made this painting? Is this I the person who's reading this painting? When they're looking at it, is the painting somehow speaking? And that ambiguity is something that you really pushed in this series of the door paintings that you see two of here, and there are 10 upstairs in the show, the first four of which quote passages from Zora Neale Hurston's How It Feels to Be Colored Me, with this eye going forward over and over again on the stencil. And maybe you can talk about your interest in these texts in particular and that she used and what she was writing about in the essay.
Well, let me say first a little bit about the door paintings, which were, they were in a way something of an accident. I knew that I wanted to use, you know, after that I Am a Man painting, I knew that I wanted to use text. But I wasn't sure, you know, after making the I Am a Man painting, where to go. And so I bought the stencils that were shown earlier and started playing around with them. And they're very similar to stencils that Jasper Johns used. So it was sort of, you know, not a big discovery on my part. But I started playing around with them. And at first I thought, well, I'm just going to make, you know, text out of oil stick. But the stencils and oil stick, which is basically an oil crayon, you know, oil paint in a crayon form, don't really work well together. When you make a letter, it all the oil kind of spreads out behind the stencil. And so it took me about 6 months to realize that that was interesting, you know, that the fact that I couldn't make very crisp, clean letters with these stencils using oil paint was actually the interesting thing about them. And so I had a door panel in a studio that I had, and the building that the studio was in was very big, and to throw out the trash, you had to literally walk three blocks down. And I was just too lazy, so I just kept moving this door panel around my studio whenever I needed the wall behind it, instead of throwing it out. And then after a month or so of moving this around, I realized, like, oh, this is a very comfortable format. You know, it's sort of doors are scale for the human body. The text that I was reading and thinking about in terms of using for these paintings had the word I in them. I feel most colored when thrown against a sharp white background. I am not tragically colored. So there was always this sort of reference to personhood somehow in the text. And so one day I just sort of started at the top of this door panel and went to the bottom using the letter stencil and let the paint that accumulated on the letter stencil smear the letters as I was making it. So the more letters you make, the more that text smears and disappears. So it's sort of the act of writing becomes a sort of contradictory thing where you're writing something over and over again, but as you're writing it, it goes more and more away. It disappears, it turns into something else. And so the idea of language changing over time, changing down the space of that door panel became really interesting to me.
I think what else may be great to mention is for those of you who don't know this text, it's written by Zora Neale Hurston, and she really describes this kind of dawning awareness of, let's say, being black only after she had left the confines of a sort of more protective black community in which she was raised, and this recognition of race maybe as something that is learned from outside yourself or that you aren't quite born with but come to later based on the way other people see you. And what I think is really fascinating, very moving about these paintings is the way that they in some ways I don't want to say enact exactly, but find a kind of metaphorical resonance with what it is that these texts are describing, both the way that they thicken and, let's say, blacken, but I think even more abstractly, the way that this kind of loss of self, of legibility that one has when you're looking at the surface, how hard it is to read, how hard it is to find your way through, find some kind of resonance for what she was describing, let's say. Mm-hmm. And also that through this process, Glenn had found a way to make paintings that were still abstract paintings, like the kind you'd been making before, but now all of the painterly incident in the work is really coming from this process of inscribing the surface with the stencil.
Well, I think what was important was the idea that I was even though these paintings seem very autobiographical on first look because of the word I in them, there was a bit of distance there because I'm using a stencil, because of the, you know, the text in the paintings or quotations. There was a bit of distance between myself and the quote, but also a kind of confusion, as you said before. One doesn't know quite exactly who that I is that's speaking in the painting. And for me, I think, you know, when I'm reading something, I'm not reading to find text for paintings. I'm reading to read. And that Zora Neale Hurston essay, I think I'd read a dozen times. And it just stuck with me. And these sentences that jumped out of it, I think, you know, after a while, I realized, like, oh, I have these texts already. They're already in my head. You know, I have a text to use. In the same way that I am a man, you know, that sign stayed in my head for all those years after I'd first saw it. And it was just finding a form to use that in, you know.
I think that's a good segue to these other two paintings, because a lot of the discussion around Glenn's work, the kind of one-line bio, is that this is an artist who uses the African-American literary tradition, and that, you know, people think of his relationship, let's say, to writers like James Baldwin and Zora Neale Hurston. But there's really a range of texts in this show. Some are spoken, some come from recordings, some come from things that you read. Some of the authors who wrote them are white, some are black. And here's just two other examples. This text, I Am Somebody, which, of course, is great, and it's sort of declarative, you know, thrust, and that you read this over and over again, and the more you read it, the more you think you have no idea who you are. Who is this somebody, this stutter, the way it introduces this kind of doubt. And this is actually a quote from Jesse Jackson. And on the right, the word passing over and over again, which you'll see upstairs. I don't know if you want to say anything specific about either one of these texts.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the texts that I first started with, Zora Neale Hurston, Genet, Baldwin,
Shelley.
Whitman, Mary Shelley, were coming from literary sources. And it was interesting to me to start to use something that was more about the voice. So, you know, I sort of imagine, you know, I'm sort of hearing Jesse Jackson saying at these rallies, you know, I am somebody, you know, sort of over and over again. And that's the sort of idea of the speaking voice became sort of important to me, you know, as a way of, you know, a different kind of voice in these paintings.
Well, that's a good segue to these paintings.
We're doing good segue tonight.
Give you a good segue in Fort Worth.
Which you'll see in the next gallery in the show. And these are also spoken voice paintings from comedy routines, if you can call them comedy, or social satire of Richard Pryor. And there are eight of these paintings in the show. And they were made mostly in the early 90s, although some come later and we can talk about that. But maybe you could start by just talking about your interest in Richard Pryor, apart from even that, bringing the spoken voice into your painting.
Well,
how did you know Pryor?
Richard Pryor was not something my mother let my brother and I listen to when we were kids. So just put that thought to rest. But we had older cousins. The joy of older cousins is they can do what they want and sneak you up to their rooms and put it on the record player. So, you know, when I was 13 and 14, my cousin Derby in Washington, he was 17 or 18. He did all sorts of bad things, but he had a record player and Richard Pryor records and his own money. So he could go out and buy Richard Pryor paintings, and we'd go up to his room and listen to them. And so that was my introduction. But, you know, many, many years later, when I'm thinking about this sort of issue of voice in these paintings and how the sources of the paintings were primarily literary sources, I thought, well, if you look at Richard Pryor's comedy routines, they're jokes, but they often aren't funny, you know? They're often very sort of pointed satire or commentary on American culture and relations between the sexes, and I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to bring that sort of voice into my work. But also, you know, I'm of a certain generation that's, you know, saw Richard Pryor perform, you know, saw 8-tracks, you know, heard 8-tracks and listened to the records and watched him on videotapes. So I have this very specific relationship to Richard Pryor as a performer, how he moved around the stage, what his voice sounded like. And so to bring that kind of, you know, knowledge to these paintings was interesting to me. But also, I was very interested in Warhol. So this was a way for me to deal with color again, sort of looking at Warhol's self-portraits from the early 60s and these incredible kind of color combinations that he did, and trying to think through color again, because the work before this was primarily black and white, you know. So it was a sort of way to return to, in a way, to that first painting you showed, the kind of abstract painting where I was dealing more with color.
Well, I think one of the things that people will experience when they're upstairs in the show is the incredible optical punch of these paintings after a room that's mostly black and white, and the way that there's a kind of analogy between the kind of difficulty of Pryor's language and what he's talking about, the kinds of words he uses, the aggressiveness of them, and then these paintings that are kind of assaulting you. You know, some of them are, in fact, difficult to read or look at, both because of what they're talking about, but also because of just the kind of optical vibration you're getting when you stand in front of them. And it seems like that must be something you were very interested in as you made them.
But also, you can't make black and white Richard Pryor jokes. You know, they needed color.
Silver and black ones.
Well, I made silver and black ones, but that was, you know, Silver Streak and all of that, you know. So there was a movie that Richard, a bad movie with Gene Wilder called Silver Streak. But so that was a bit my homage to Silver Streak.
Are we talking about this painting or keep moving?
No, we'll keep moving.
Go upstairs to read this painting.
Yeah.
And then kind of just to, I think, conclude this portion where we're talking about the kinds of text that you've used in your paintings before we move on to images in your paintings. There are some, I promise, if any of you are ready to get up and leave. The most extended period of working or the body of work that you've made the most paintings from the same text is this text of James Baldwin's Stranger in the Village, and it's a body of work that even continues today. It sort of really has gone on for more than 10 years, some text that you keep coming back to and have found different ways to explore. It's hard for people to see this in this slide, but what you are looking at is a black gessoed ground, a large painting. It's 96 inches tall. That's covered basically with black paint and then has black stenciling on top of that and then black coal dust that's thrown on top of that. So it's a very rich, kind of crusty surface that makes the painting very difficult to read, much more so than any of the other paintings in the show. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk first about James Baldwin and this essay, if you want, and how you, what your interest in Baldwin was.
Well, the essay was written in the 50s. It's a moment when Baldwin, an African-American writer, has gone to Switzerland. He's sort of self-exiled in France, but he's then gone to Switzerland to a chalet that's owned by his boyfriend, I guess we should say. He's gone there to write a novel, but he, in mid-50s in Switzerland, in this mountain town, this very remote mountain village, he finds for many of the villagers that he's the first black person they've seen, literally. First black person they've seen. And so the essay becomes about, you know, the stranger in the village, his sort of encounter with people who have no knowledge of him. But I think, you know, what's interesting about the essay is that it's incredibly panoramic. So he starts out with this very particular fact. I am living in this village writing my novel, and I'm an African American, and for many of these people, I'm the first person they've seen. But then he starts to talk more generally about, you know, his relationship to European culture, Europe's relationship to its colonies in Africa, race relationships in the United States, you know, the fear and fascination that a stranger can generate in any situation, you know. And so the essay is quite panoramic and quite rich. But also, I think Baldwin, you know, he was sort of trained, he was a boy preacher. And so you see that in his essays, particularly these sort of very long, complicated, you know, metaphor rich, you know, sentences. And so I was very attracted to the essay, but in thinking about using this text, I thought I need something that kind of mirrors the gravity and weight density of the ideas in this essay. I think I was working on a totally different project, and I was at a silk screener. We were doing something, and I think I was talking about trying to make paintings using Stranger in the Village, this text, and saying, oh, I need something that's like material, you know, that's weight, but somehow. And the printer said, oh, well, what about this stuff called Magnum?
And I'm like, what's that? And it's like, coal dust. And the minute he said it, I knew it was perfect. I hadn't even seen it. But and so I went out and found it. And artists are suckers, basically. I went to an art supply store, and they were selling this coal dust for $3 a quart. And then the store I always went to ran out. And I was desperate. I was trying to finish this painting. I didn't have enough. And so I'm calling around all these places. Nobody had it. And it's like, I decided to, like, well, it's coal dust. Maybe I should call a coal manufacturer. So I call some guy in Tennessee. And he's like, what? Coal dust? Oh, you mean Black Beauty. So that was actually the sort of and it's used for, like, sandblasting and fill and construction projects. And I've been buying it for $3 a quart. And I was like, so how much is it? They're like, $10. I'm like, $10 a quart? It's like, no, or 100 pounds. So it cost more to ship the thing to me from Tennessee than it was actually worth. But the density of that material, that it's shiny, that it's a waste product, like all of the sort of associations with, you know, coal and... it was really interesting to me. So it added, you know, so basically the process is the same as the other paintings. I'm stenciling one letter at a time with oil stick, but while the oil stick is wet, I'm putting coal dust on top of it, and the coal dust is sticking to that oil stick, which both gives it this sort of sculptural quality, but also makes the text very difficult to read. And that sort of struggle that viewers have with the text, I think, is... in a way, enacting the struggle that any writer goes through trying to make a text that's trying to communicate something that's incredibly difficult and complex. You know,
that was interesting. A lot of times when I would give tours of the show in New York, people would get very frustrated with these paintings and say, well, I can't read the text, or why would he cover them with this coal dust if he cared about the text? Why would he want them to be read? And I would, you know, try to get people to think about, in fact, what that frustration that they were feeling was and how, in a way, that could be kind of part of the meaning of the work and
relate
to... in different ways, what Baldwin was talking about, the kind of blindness of these people to him, or his legibility, but also his illegibility, and the kind of way that these paintings really get people, I don't say upset, but sort of struggle to make sense of them, I think has a great resonance. And interestingly, Baldwin concludes this essay very optimistically, rather optimistically, to the extent that he says, look, in Europe... you know, Black people will never be a part of this culture and the society, and in the States, for better or worse, despite, you know, all of the terrible segregation and whatnot that was happening at that time, that they're sort of inextricably bound up in this nation's fabric and history. And I think that these paintings, I don't say that they're balancing optimism around, but in the kind of beauty of them and the sort of reflective qualities it's hard to get a sense of the kind of sensuality, because really in Black Square, but trust me on this, that there is some kind of, I don't want to say redemptive tone, but there's something about them that's beautiful within this sort of space of also, let's say, frustration or anxiety or darkness.
But I think those things have to be, you know, if you're dealing with the kind of issues that Baldwin was dealing with in that essay, those things make sense together, you know? I was laughing with someone. I had a residency in Memphis, and I did a sort of article for an art magazine about my residency down there, and I said I went to the Civil Rights Museum one day, which by definition is somewhat depressing, you know, meaning that, like, that museum has to be about the difficulty of race relations in this country, and it can't just be all cheerful, you know. And so I think part of, you know, a writer's task, someone like Baldwin, is trying to deal with, like, the complexity and difficulties of these issues, but also remaining kind of optimistic, you know, saying that, like, this country is not what it was. It's changed, you know. And so there is a kind of optimistic tone in that essay.
And speaking of the panorama, this is a 12-foot wide painting. So when you're in front of it, you're kind of engulfed in it, the way that you maybe are used to seeing big paintings, whether they're by Pollock or French old paintings. It has this kind of panoramic quality, the sense of a landscape that Glenn is sort of feeling his way through words, but also quite physically. We're going to have to, I think, skip some bodies of work at the rate that we're going.
Okay, they're upstairs.
we can talk about this one, because I think it's one that people will find interesting. This is a picture of the exhibition at the Whitney, which we tried for the first time to reprise a body of work. Terry mentioned that Glenn had a show at the Hirshhorn in 1993, and it was called To Disembark, and it actually had a number of different parts, these crates on the floor which played music, different soundtracks, which you'll hear upstairs, in fact. Bob Marley singing Redemption Song, Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, KRS-One, Sound of the Police, and then a recording of Glenn reading the narrative of Henry Box Brown, who is a slave who famously shipped himself to freedom via the U.S. Postal Service in a crate. And that was sort of, that story was kind of the impetus for this body of work that you explored with sculptures and these prints. And so maybe you could talk about your interest in that text or the kind of work that you made. We have pictures of the prints also if you want to show them.
A lot of the work that I've done, it sort of starts with just looking at things. And this body of work started by really just going to the library and looking through clipping files. And I, you know, sort of found this lithograph that was a image of Henry Box Brown being liberated from this crate that he had been shipped to from Richmond, Virginia to Philadelphia, to this anti-slavery society in Philadelphia. And so the images of him being freed from this box. And I got quite fascinated with the idea of the body contained in this box, but also after reading his narrative with the idea of the thing that would have given him away would have been his voice if he'd spoken out. And so that was sort of the text that generated these crates and then these other forms here, runaway posters, and then narratives, which you'll see. But one of the things I was thinking about in terms of the runaways, which is one of what you see here, is the idea that I'd seen a lot of artwork that dealt with slavery somehow. But I felt that it always positioned slavery as something that was in the past that needed to be sort of thought about again, but still was somehow comfortably in the past. And I thought, well, slavery is sort of like problem of American democracy. It's here when our laws and, you know, when the government's being formed or our laws and institutions are arising. It's sort of like this moral problem that American democracy sort of is trying to deal with. But what if one thinks about slavery as something whose effects still remain with us, are still resonate in the present? And so one of the things I tried to do with this installation was think about forms that look like or mimic forms from the past, like a poster advertising for the return of a runaway slave, but contemporize it by simply doing something like asking friends to describe me as if I'd gone missing and had to describe me to the police, and just plugging in their descriptions into these formats that sort of mimic these runaway slave posters. It's a very unsettling thing to have your friends describe you. But what was interesting, because you get, you know, there are 10 of these, or 9 of these, 10 of these?
10 of these.
10 of these, and you get 10 very different kinds of descriptions. It was a little startling.
I think that, you know, when you said this unsettling thing, it kind of transfers to a lot of the people who look at this work, because in a way it's very funny and you're kind of laughing, but then another way you are struck by, as Glenn said, this kind of missing persons report to the police. And certainly in this society there's such a kind of overemphasis, let's say, on, you know, black male criminality and the way that people talk about police, and the idea that Glenn is willing to inhabit this history in a way that's both humorous and also sort of scary or disturbing is, I think, what's partly the honesty and he's very tactful in the way he takes on history and these issues, because he's not really yelling at anyone but kind of questioning things. You can see that in this series of prints, which is in the same room where he sort of made these slave narrative frontispiece and cover prints that look like the conventions of these 18th and 19th century books, but cast himself as the author and the star of them, sort of like in Box Brown's narrative.
Mm-hmm. Which was, again, about the sort of bringing the past to the present and making sort of connections between them, using bits and pieces of dozens and dozens of actual slave narratives, but just changing a few things to make them into autobiographical, seemingly autobiographical narratives. And What's important about them is that they're, you know, there are 9 of these narratives and 10 runaway posters. So there's sort of the idea also that no one text or no one image describes a person. You know, there are 9 different versions of this seeming autobiography here, 10 different versions of, you know, in the runaway posters of the person that I am. And so a lot of the work is about this kind of multiplicity, you know.
Well, another good segue is that this is actually the one that we have here. It relates to the story that you told about your mom sending you to private school, for those who can't read it, about the story of Glenn Ligon, a Negro who was sent to be educated amongst white people in the year 1966, when only about 6 years of age, and has continued to fraternize with them to the present time. And again, this is something where I would give tours of this, and everyone would kind of laugh and think like, oh, isn't it funny that he's telling this story? And then kind of pause. There's like the, almost like in the Richard Pryor thing, where you're like, wait, but this is kind of true. This is what his life was. He was sent away, and this notion that, oh, someone might fraternize with white people seems so quaint and old-fashioned, and this is like a 19th century thing, but yet it's in fact part of your life experience, and that this history and the way that our society is structured does have great resonances going back, and that way of bringing the past and the present into this dialogue, I think, is something that you'll see again and again in the show, and that Glenn really tackles in his work. We can move, I think, on, because we're going away. Should we talk about this or move to the next one?
I think, what's the next one?
Million Man?
Ooh. Let's go to that.
Okay. This is a piece about Robert Mapplethorpe's Black Book, but you'll have to see it upstairs. Here's a body of work that you'll also see upstairs that Glenn made about the Million Man March that Farrakhan organized. And perhaps maybe you could talk about, I know you didn't go to the march, but what it was that interested you in this event and how you kind of tried to approach it in your work.
I think there were a couple of issues that I was interested in. One was I hadn't really dealt with images so much, and so I was curious about, you know, how do you deal with images? How do images operate? And the Million Man March was an event in the mid-90s organized by Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. It was a march on the Mall in Washington, D.C. about the visibility of black men in the culture. And what I found interesting about the march is a sort of actually a Baldwin kind of take on the march. You know, Baldwin sort of says, like, you know, well, black people and white people have been here from the beginning. So I found it sort of interesting that there's a march organized on the Mall in Washington, D.C. to assert the visibility of people who have been here from the beginning. So I found that sort of interesting to think about. And that sort of generated my thinking about the images. So basically the way this project started is I just took images from the newspaper of the march and started playing around with them, blowing them up on a Xerox machine. And what would happen was the images got, you know, you take a tiny little black and white image from a newspaper and you blow it up 15 times on a Xerox machine, the images change. They get darker, they get less distinct. And that kind of disappearance of the image seemed to me interesting in relationship to this notion of the march being about a certain kind of visibility. But also, you know, structured in the march, it was a Million Man March. So some of the critique of the march was, you know, this writer, Amiri Baraka, said, why go to war and leave half the army behind? You know, so because women were not invited directly to participate in this gathering on the Mall. And so these sort of absences were structured into the march, and when I started playing with these images, it seemed like those absences and voids and loss of specificity came out of the way the images were done. So these are very big silkscreen pieces. This one is 10 feet tall, and it's... there was text originally on this banner where black and strong was the text, but in its generations to get it to this size, that text disappeared. And so suddenly this banner becomes opened up for a different kind of meaning or becomes more ambiguous.
So that's kind of what was interesting to me.
It was fascinating that these works were brought back on view during the New York last spring, during the height of the Arab Spring, and this kind of conversation about visibility of people in Egypt and all different places, and this uprising, and that these works meant something totally different today maybe than they did in the 90s. I didn't see them then, but that certainly the kind of closed conversation that sometimes people assume, well, Glenn's writing or making work about, you know, Black history or politics, that these works are in fact quite open-ended, and the process of the image becoming more abstract that he's describing really contributed to that feeling that I think people had when looking at these works in New York. I mean, we've also had a lot of discussion about Occupy Wall Street and what the crowd means, how it functions in an image like this with these men's hands raised. You don't really know, is this a kind of great optimistic picture of solidarity? Is there something a little ominous about this kind of groupthink? And the way that these works really opened up last spring, and so many people actually kept commenting, oh, was he interested in the Arab Spring? And I said, well, these pieces are almost 20 years old. I think shows the way that the kind of, I don't want to say the universal themes that Glenn's exploring, but that they're not really tied to any particular person or history or social group, but that they open on to these other
issues.
Well,
they start with a very specific kind of moment, but clearly, you know, these moments cycle around, you know, different players, different actors. But, you know, if you looked at images of the Arab Spring, there was a lot of initially reference to, you know, civil rights movement, you know, images from American kind of democratic struggle. So I found that really interesting, that, you know, there's a kind of, it's quite different, but there's also a sort of sense of continuity and reference in these other, you know, sort of historical moments.
I think we have maybe just one more body of work. Do you want coloring or neons?
Oh, coloring.
Coloring? Okay.
Oh, neons.
Okay, neons. Sorry. This is a preview of some of the things, again, that you'll see upstairs as they looked at the Whitney. But we want to leave time for questions, so we'll skip over some of these.
Paintings based on children's coloring in images this is 70s coloring books.
Something you'll see at the top of the stairs as you...
Nothing but trouble.
Okay, next.
Next.
Oh, this is a whole other story.
Okay.
I don't know if we even need to get into this story, but,
should
we go here?
Let's go here.
Okay, so to just talk about the kind of conclusion of the show, which feels very different here. It's quite beautiful using the Ondo architecture. You may have already seen this neon in the lobby that says the word Negro Sunshine, and there's also these three neons that use the word America in different ways down the kind of aisle that passes along the side of the show, sort of a spine. And maybe... you would like to talk about how it was that you suddenly came to use neon just in the last, let's say, 5 or 6 years, and it's a medium that a lot of different artists have used, but was something you had never really explored, and where that that interest kind of came from.
A lot of my work kind of comes from either accidents or serendipity. In this case, the serendipity, which was, I have a studio in Brooklyn, and it's in a big factory building, and on the ground floor of this factory building is a neon maker, and I, you know, walked by his shop for 2 or 3 years and never went in because I don't make neons. I don't, you know, but lots of artists, you know, that I like, Joseph Kassouf, Bruce Nauman, work in neon, but it just never occurred to me. And one day the owner of the shop was standing outside and said, oh, do you want to come in and have a tour? And so I went in and had a tour. And what was interesting about the shop is that Matt Dilling is the owner. It's called Light Bright Neon. He makes a lot of commercial signs, so Christmas displays at the Apple store or the pumpkin coach that was in the window of the Disney store. Like, he made things like that. But he also worked with artists like Nauman making neons. And so there was a sort of interesting kind of commercial and making art. And so as he was giving me the tour, really just as a joke, I said, well, you know, Matt, I've been making, you know, black and white text paintings, so what about black neon? And he said, well, black is the absence of light, so you can't really make black neon. And I was like, oh, that's true.
But then he showed me this image, actually, which is an almond, and I knew this image before, but you can see at the bottom, it says yellow and dye above it, red and dye, white and dye, black and dye. And he said, well, this was made by taking a very dark blue neon tube and painting the front of it black. And when he said that, I realized, oh, Negro Sunshine, which was a text that I'd already been using to make drawings of. It's a little fragment from a Gertrude Stein novel. And I thought, I've already got the text for you. So we made the sign that's a version of the sign that's out in the lobby by just taking a white neon tube and painting the front of it black. So it appears and disappears at the same time. It registers as a black line, but also is kind of eclipsed somehow. And then I started making these pieces using the word America, and they came from an odd place too, which is that I've been trying to make a piece using Dickens' Tale of Two Cities for years and could never quite figure out what to do, and was really fascinated by the opening of the novel. You know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, a very famous kind of opening of the novel, and was trying to make text work using those lines, and nothing ever worked. And then suddenly I realized, oh, well, Dickens is talking about a moment in a particular society. And the moment that I started making these American neons seemed like a similar moment. And so I thought, oh, it's not about using Dickens, it's about the idea of best of times, worst of times.
Can you talk about that moment?
Well, you know, 2006, the economy is booming, we're in a war, you know. It was sort of like these kinds of oppositions were on my mind. And so this idea of America as this sort of shining light, but also somehow kind of eclipsed at the same time, was what these neons were about for me.
And the Rugen figure?
Yeah, this neon actually blinks. You'll see
very
it flashes.
Very aggressively and annoyingly.
So it's a kind of like a sign on the fritz almost, yeah. Which is interesting if you think about the way that this is a country, whether it's through its wars or its TV shows or what have you, that's always advertised itself to the world. And this kind of vernacular shop sign style that Glenn used, but then to kind of make a piece about the way that we maybe broadcast ourselves, but that there's something a little broken here. It's we're this shining beacon, this light, as you said, but then it's kind of like not quite working. So when you see it, it is annoying, as Glenn said. And you even see the kind of cords coming down. This is hanging up above head height on the wall. Here's one actually that the Tate owns, which you'll see upstairs, that's entirely painted in black. So the only bit of light that comes through are where there are little chips in the paint, and this idea maybe of this...
it's a potential, kind of, you know.
And you don't really know what's on. And then the final one, which you'll also see, and this one's called Rücken figure, which is an art historical term in German for the kind of figure that you see from the back, let's say, in a kind of German landscape paintings, if you know the work of Caspar David Friedrich, where there's a figure from behind in the landscape and you're meant to identify with this figure. And so you're looking at the backs of these letters, but it's confusing at first because you think that maybe the whole sign was turned around when in fact you realize, well, if that had happened, then the M would be over on the other side. And then it's kind of like, well, what is going on in this sign? Well, because the A and the M and the I are all symmetrical bilaterally, if you flip them around, they still look like they're facing forward. And so this kind of tension between letters that look backwards and letters that look forwards, even when they're backwards, I think maybe has something to do with the kind of emotional energy of this piece.
Right. But also, I think an accident. I had taken an image of one of the other American neons, and I was doing something in Photoshop I'm terrible at stuff like that. And, you know, you flip horizontally, you flip vertically, and suddenly it's like, oh, what happened to this piece? And then I realized, oh, symmetrical letters. And so it really came from that, you know, kind of like suddenly the image, I thought, oh, that's very interesting.
Well, just like the oil stick in the beginning with your stencil was
right.
An accident.
So there's always this sort of moment when I realize that I've screwed something up, but then I sort of have the good sense to realize that screwing up actually might be productive. And so it was like this piece, suddenly seeing the image like this on a computer screen and realize, oh, I can make that. So basically we made
American neon with black paint on the front and just turn the letters around, you know. And so it's sort of facing the wall, basically. So it's, but somehow because of that, you know, the symmetry of the A or the M, it's facing you and facing away at the same time, which is, as Scott said, a reference to sort of those Caspar Friedrich paintings that I was very taken by.
You know, in a way, how you can sort of identify with this country or feel proud of it, let's say, but then at the same time feel alienated or that certain things you don't agree with, or that it holds together as a word, as a union, as a thought, but then also has its kind of splintering that happens the more time you spend in front of it. And that kind of flipping back and forth in your mind, I think, is kind of part of the meaning of the work or the way that people can understand it. I think with that, we can... Oh, there you can just see how the black paint is facing the wall, and you see the connections. It's, the piece feels kind of fragile to me, actually, and sort of vulnerable because the chords are...
It is fragile.
Well, it is, actually, yeah. It's literally fragile. We won't get into that.
Okay.
It will be illuminated
when
the exhibition opens.
We promise.
We promise. All wires will be working. And then here you see the piece, actually, that's hanging upstairs, a kind of bad photograph. I'm sorry, but we asked Glenn, when he had his show at the Whitney, if there was anything he wanted to do for the window that faces Madison Avenue. It's very public-facing. There's a bus stop right there. Lots of people are walking by who don't ever go to the Whitney. And he had the idea that he wanted to blow up this Negro Sunshine neon and turn it literally into a shop sign window to kind of bring it back to that vernacular. But funny enough, we were opening a new restaurant downstairs at the same time, and people kept asking us, oh, is that the name of your new Danny Meyer restaurant, Negro Sunshine?
Which I thought was brilliant.
And I was happy to sell it to him.
We had to talk to the waiters about how to answer questions. But it was amazing as a kind of, I think, kind of ambiguous sign for the exhibition. Obviously, Glenn's name was nowhere, and it would stop people in traffic, and people took pictures of it, and we're glad that it gets to be here in Fort Worth for its final showing. And I think on that note, because we promised to stay fairly on time, we're a little over. Terry, do we have time for questions, or are you okay? Okay, tell us when. So if you want to bring up the lights, Glenn is happy to answer any questions you might have. And thank you for your patience.
Yes, thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
A couple things quickly. And for those of us who can't be here in 25 more years, since this is a mid-career retrospective, what can we expect in the future? Since you fraternized with whites, did that affect your relationship with the black community? And have the black community perceive you?
Let's just have two questions for now, because there's a lot of people here.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I'm sort of, you know, the interesting thing about a retrospective is you get to see a lot of work that you've done, obviously, for, you know, in this case, 25 years of work. But for me as an artist, what's interesting about it is that one sees in various projects ways that roads not taken. And so that's kind of interesting to see the show. And I'm sort of